This is an audio version of the 24th Annual Dice Awards Roundtable Series. To watch the video of this episode, please visit youtube.com/officialAIAS.
Brought to you by the Academy of Interactive Arts and Sciences. This is the award celebration by game makers for game makers, honoring the games that connect players around the globe. No matter where we come from or what our interests, video games bring us together. We gather here to honor our fellow creators and the very best of interactive entertainment. Welcome to the 24th Annual Dice Awards.
Okay, everybody, I'm here with the nominees for Outstanding Achievement in Game Direction. This is the 24th Annual Dice Awards Developer Discussions. We'll be talking about what makes each of these games special and makes each of the connections to these games in this category, because for the first time, we have all these folks together and hanging out together while we do our conversation today. So let's have some introductions for all the folks in the room. First up, from Ghost of Tsushima, we have Nate Fox and Jason Connell. How are you doing?
Great. It's a pleasure to be here.
Excited for you both to be here. Nate, give the folks at home a little bit of info about the work that you've been up to over your illustrious career.
Right on. Well, I come from game design by way of art. My first job was animating bulls in a bull riding game. And now, it's been all downhill from there. And now I just, my focus as a creative director on Ghost of Tsushima is game design and narrative.
I love it. Jason, give the folks at home a little bit of info about the work you've done.
Yeah, I come from more of an art background. Spent the last 10 years of my time working on Sucker Punch games, ranging from doing lighting work up until more recently on this game, getting a chance to do art direction and helping out with the creative direction of the game.
Fantastic. Thank you so much for both being here. From the team over at Hades, we have Greg Kasavin. How are you doing, Greg?
Doing really well. Thank you.
Good to have you. Give the folks at home a little bit of information about the work you've done in this space as well.
Yeah, I'm the writer and creative director on Hades. I've been working at Supergiant for more than a decade now on our past games, ever since the Bastion days. My old background is in the gaming press. So I used to be a game critic in my past life, though I got to chase after my lifelong dream of kind of writing and designing games, getting my hands dirty with the actual development as part of our small team at Supergiant. We're based in San Francisco and just kind of want to stick together for as long as we can. Keep making
fantastic stuff. Thank you so much for being here as well. From the team over at Half-Life Alyx, we have Greg Coomer. How are you doing, Greg?
Doing great. Thanks. Good to be here.
Good to have you as well. Give the folks at home a little bit of information about the work you've done.
I work at Valve. I've worked at Valve since back when we shipped Half-Life. It's the only game, it's the only job I've ever had in the game industry. Helped start Valve back in 1996, and it's been a pretty great ride since then.
Pretty fantastic. Thank you so much for being here with us today. From the team over at Kentucky Route Zero TV Edition, we have Jake Elliott. How are you doing, Jake?
Hi, not bad, thanks.
Good to see you, good to see you. Give the folks at home a little bit of info about yourself as well.
Our studio is called Cardboard Computer, and it's a pretty small group. It's just three of us. And we kind of, before we started making games, we've made one game. It's called Kentucky Route Zero. Before that, we were working on other kinds of art projects like installation art and performance stuff for several years before that. So this game that we worked on now kind of grew out of our collaborative relationship that we had already. And my role is to do the writing for the game and also some of the programming and design that we all kind of share, programming design and sort of storyboarding stuff. But that's my role.
Awesome. Thank you so much for being here as well. And to round us out from The Last of Us 2, we have Kurt Magenow and Anthony Newman. How are you both doing, gents?
Good. Pretty good. Great to be here. Super cool to be in this group. Great to be on a Zoom call with Greg Kasavin. I'm totally stoked to be on a call with you. It was really awesome to see your jump from press to dev and see that go so well for you. That's awesome. Work at Naughty Dog a little over a decade now, and started way back on Uncharted 2 with Kurt. We both kind of came up in the gameplay scripting part of the dev process. Really great to be here.
Kurt, share a little bit of info about yourself as well.
Yeah, I've been similar story. We came up together. I started about over 12 years ago, Naughty Dog, been a designer, technical designer, designer, lead designer, and various Uncharted and Last of Us, Last of Us 2, co-game directing with Anthony.
Awesome, awesome, awesome. Thank you so much, all of you, for being here.
Right now. Neil is also a director with us, Neil Druckmann.
Awesome. Sorry, I didn't hear that last part. I cut you off by accident. Apologies for that. I'm super excited to talk to you all again. You know, the work you've all done has been brilliant and fantastic. You've made some super awesome games in the space. You know, most of you have kind of worked in this space for a bunch of different years and worked on your game for a long time. You know, thinking back to when you kind of started, you know, the process of making the games that you've made and kind of, you know, where things have landed, do you feel like the process itself has kind of changed you and how you kind of learned along the way of how to kind of do this work in bigger and broader and kind of bolder ways in terms of the games that you have made? Greg, I'm going to go to you. Rick Asavin, I'm going to go to you on that one first. You know, thinking about that in kind of the broader sense, you know, how is the game development part of all this kind of changed you and it made you kind of think about it broader in game direction?
Yeah, it's, you know, the first thing that came to mind is how in my role, when I first started at Supergiant, you know, there's this temptation as when you have this title of creative director, it's like, well, you think of these kind of visionary game creators in the industry and you feel this pressure that, you know, the ideas must come from you. But really, I think it can be very successful to have an environment in which the ideas can come from anywhere on the team. And over time, I felt very distinctly my role evolve to become that of just trying to ensure that my colleagues have kind of the most creative freedom possible to do the work that makes them the most excited, and then find ways to tie it all together and make it feel like we planned it that way all from the start. And just kind of prioritizing my colleagues' excitement, even over my own, is something that kind of clicked in my mind over time. It's not something that I felt going in, but something that I learned working with the same group over a long period of time. You know, of course, many, many aspects of game development have changed over time, and it's it never, I often say, you know, with a smile, but deadly serious, that it never gets any easier, because just when you think you finally know what you're doing, the whole industry changes and you have to learn everything all over again. That certainly keeps it interesting, though.
Yeah, I can assume, you know, just how much that has actually really changed. You know, we had that conversation about you kind of starting in press and then moving over and having that part of it change. So I'm sure that is not only for you a very different change, but for many of the folks here in the room as well, that's been a monumental change in how that's worked. Jake, I'm kind of curious about that, especially from your perspective, being in a really small team, of, you know, how the process has started for you when you kind of thought about, hey, I'm going to go actually try to make a game. And now as you've put something out in the world, what has changed for you in that perspective?
Yeah, well, first off, I relate a lot to what Greg was describing about sort of like the passion of the team and the excitement, like letting everybody sort of follow their passion to the extent that is possible. And you know, that was just, we're all, the three of us are all kind of on the, there's no hierarchy really for the three of us. So it's like, that's sort of naturally what the arrangement was, you know, it's just like follow the interest. And I mean, you can really see it in your studio's work, right? Because the games are all so full of passion and so many different elements, and it really comes through. And I found for us, you know, we sort of put some stakes in the ground in the beginning of developing the game about, you know, how it was going to end in some form and some things that were going to happen in the middle. But we really tried to leave a lot of open space and leave a lot of blank spots in the story from the start, in order to kind of give us space to follow our passions. And the result is that sometimes the game feels very schizophrenic or you know, at least it feels very like it's going off in a lot of diverse directions. But I think that kind of energy comes through, that this is the sort of messy energy of a group of artists kind of exploring whatever they were interested in at the moment that they were working on that act. Yeah. And so that was really important for us to sort of learn how to maintain spontaneity over the course of, you know, we started working on this game in the summer of 2010. So over the course of about 10 years, how to maintain spontaneity and leave room for whatever it was that we were excited about 8 years from now or whatever to sort of like find a home in the game. That was something that we've gotten a little bit better at, but we're still working on.
Yeah. Yeah. I love hearing that because it does kind of, you know, readjust some of the expectations that you have in your mind too, about what that looks like from a broader perspective. You know, Greg, I'd like to poke you about that, especially having worked at Valve for as long as you have, to hear your thoughts about, you know, what has changed for you in the way that you think of, you know, the process of making games in this way, and having seen the changes from a technology standpoint, from a conversational standpoint, from all the ways that you've gone and kind of touched the game space. You know, how's that all kind of affected the way you've kind of thought about the process?
Well, for me, I think the biggest change actually happened way back when Valve started making games. I wouldn't have really thought before I worked at Valve that our method of making games would work out very well. Namely that, you know, we don't really have a director. Everybody, you know, just like Greg Kasavin was saying, and Jake, even at a studio of, you know, now significant size and a team that is quite a few people, nobody has a job description, or there's no division of labor and there's no hierarchy. And I think that having a game come together in an atmosphere and environment like that is always amazing. And, you know, before I worked at Valve, you know, just wouldn't have been certain that we could pull that off. And, you know, worked during Half-Life 1 and worked, you know, for so many games. And again, on Half-Life Alyx, we were, you know, it just was really an honor to be a part of the team. I'm here representing the team's direction, but it really was a kind of equivalent effort across the entire group.
Yeah. It does really pull together into focus, you know, just how many people it takes to get a game out into the world. I'm always amazed at that when I hear the numbers of folks who are kind of in a studio and how many folks have spent so much time and effort and energy to kind of make a game be a thing. It is still astounding to be in that way. Nate and Jason, I'm curious to hear your thoughts about that too, with the lineage of games that you all kind of worked on and, you know, kind of culminating with Ghost of Tsushima. You know, what's the process look like for both of you in that way, where you're kind of rethinking and kind of broadening out, I'm sure, the conversations, not only between yourselves, but with across the folks in the studio? Nate, I'll start with you on that one.
Sure. Well, I certainly agree that a core element that makes the game happen is the passion of the people around you that are all so invested in putting their creativity into making it work. And one of the things that's just changed tremendously for us, you know, going from Rocket Robot on Wheels all the way up to Ghost, is that as the scale of the team gets bigger and the scope of the game gets bigger, more than ever, providing a sense of unified vision for what it is that everybody's working on becomes absolutely paramount, so that those passions all pull in the same direction. For us, that's been a bit of a learning curve, and it's kind of a strange work product. As a, you know, as I'm sure we've all done this, you know, as directors, it's our job to get people emotionally invested for this thing that it's going to take years to make. And so you have to be able to communicate this idea that's just an abstraction in a way that people can say, ah, I get it, it clicks in my head. Let's all pull forward. And that, I'd say, is the biggest change from my perspective between games that are made now versus, you know, 15 years ago. And it's really just a product of the scale of the team.
Yeah. Jason, any quick things to add to that?
Oh, I'm just kind of amazed at, like, the kind of games that people can make from one person, three person teams, all the way up to, you know, 1,000 people. It's just crazy. So this is just such an evolving topic and it's very different for every single team. I say for Ghost in particular, the big work environment change that I experienced over the course of this game was involving people that you wouldn't involve in normal game development. You know, technical artists, programmers, whatever. That's very typical. But, you know, reaching out to cultural consultants, mannerisms coaches, and dialect coaches, and script reviewers from Japan, and, you know, and just really adding a whole new category of people to help make your game was such an evolving thing for us. And, you know, we're not directing them at all. Like, they're our peers and helping kind of guide and coach us. And that was profoundly different. I don't think I've ever experienced that before. So that was a big learning takeaway for us at the studio.
Yeah. Fantastic. I love hearing stories about that, because it is a big task to kind of pull in all those pieces together to make it all work right. Kurt and Anthony, I'm really curious about, you know, from a narrative perspective, you all were going very, very big and ambitious with the story you told in Last of Us 2. I think, you know, there were some parts of the overall experience that people kind of remember and kind of dig into. But I'd love to hear from both of you, you know, what parts of the overall experience do you feel were the kind of the ones you felt were the most improved with the second game? Things you kind of really leaned into that you said, you know, we want to make sure we tackle this in a bigger and kind of more profound way. And what were some of the lessons you kind of learned through the process of implementing those things in the sequel? I'll start with you, Anthony, first.
Yeah. There were so many things we were trying to innovate on with Last of Us Part One. Mm-hmm. You know, it's kind of like a action game with a close third-person camera, kind of like Gears of War, but also with melee and also with stealth. So there were a lot of like mechanical things that were like pretty different. This ever-present ally, like kind of our most nuanced and, you know, complex ally that we had done yet in the form of Ellie. And it was at the tail end of a console generation. And so like that game was kind of shipped on, you know, stuck together with bubblegum and bits of twine to just barely ship in memory on the PlayStation 3. God, that's a long time ago. So there was a lot of stuff of just like, okay, we just figured this out. And I think the thing that I was really excited about coming to the sequel is like, okay, let's take all of that stuff and either recontextualize it or take it to another level. So it's like, okay, we've had combat. What does it look like when you have combat and swimming? Like, what if you are able to swim through these environments? What does it look like if you know, we've done combat in like these broken down artificial environments, urban environments? What does it look like to have combat in a forest with like all this like grass all over the place in a very naturalistic space? So I think for us, it was like, okay, let's not sit on our laurels. Like, and there were a lot of things that we were just like, oh, like there was no way we could have even like dreamed to do these things when we were just barely shipping this other thing. Now that we have this foundation, like how can we jump off of that and basically find new permutations, new ways of displaying these things, new contexts.
Kurt, any thoughts to add to that?
I would say that The Last of Us, like in terms of things that we focused on, I would say like The Last of Us Part Two, for me, in like thinking about it on this high, high level, it's like a magic trick of empathy that we're trying to get you to experience. Like, we want to do this whole game as a way of making you understand why someone would do something that on the surface is very, very, very bad. Now is kind of the whole entire concept. And we have this saying that we say to each other on the stick of, you know, emotional moments that happen in a narrative, being able to play them, and things that we developed during the Uncharted series and like built sequences around, and we get, you know, the feeling of, you know, exploration or the feeling of like a crazy action set piece or something, like things that we've been building on through the years of like making you feel in the core mechanics of the game, this certain emotion. And to me, The Last of Us Part Two is that taken to the macro scale of like an entire 15-hour experience of playing as someone. So I guess like that's like the heady answer, but to me, that's how I think about it.
Yeah, it's so hard. And I think, you know, I'm going to poke Jake about this in a second, but it's like, you know, really difficult sometimes to, you know, when you're thinking about the process of building out the worlds and building out those connective tissues of, you know, how much stuff do you get to infuse in the game that, you know, are kind of the core parts of it, when with the knowing that you're always going to have to cut bits of it because of time and scale and all those kinds of parts that go together with it. Jake, I'm curious about that from your perspective with Kentucky Route Zero. You know, like, you've built out this really comprehensive and really interesting story. But it feels like there was always a little bit more that kind of wanted to be get into that mix. You know, how did you kind of fit all of it into this game that, that you've made?
Yeah, I don't think we fit everything in there that, you know, we were interested in. We have like tons of notes of ideas that we were kind of exploring and research we were doing during the game and just half remembered ideas and stuff like that, that we tried to find places for. And, you know, I've heard somebody recently saying that the way you finish a game is not by checking off the last thing on your list, but by crossing it out. Like basically you just move the goalposts and that's how you finish something. And so I think that was something that we did over and over again, every time there was time to just, we have to put it out now. And then another thing that was important for us was to say, once it's out, we can't change it. You know, even though we were doing this episodic thing, we can't go back and edit earlier episodes to make it match what came later or anything. We just sort of cut off that avenue for ourselves. But so in the end, you do have some sort of some parts where there, it feels like there's maybe a little bit more, you know, and some of that is just really hard to see as a writer or creator. You know, it's like really hard to tell what how much of what's in your head you've put down. Maybe in larger teams, a sort of director role could be really good for that. You know, it's sort of like making sure that things are reading the way that you know, that each person in the team was sort of trying to get it to read. I guess for us, we just kind of like play the game together as we're working on it, and we just sort of talk about our experience with it. But it's a pretty small informal process, to be sure.
Yeah. I always wonder, you know, what winds up happening when it comes to the, you know, when you moved up the ranks and you've then become a game director. You know, how hard is it to, you know, bridge those gaps where, you know, miscommunication happens? You know, sometimes folks are new to the role and they're like, I don't know what it's like to lead a whole big crew of folks, you know, kind of in the space doing that work, and kind of infusing themselves within all the things you have to then take under account when you're doing that work, you know?
Yeah. Like if I could just follow up for real quick, sorry.
Yeah, please.
I also have read about discussions about directing actors, and you know, sort of what that job is like, the director who works with actors, and I find that it seems like the director's first role is to sort of be the first audience for the performers, you know. And I think a directorial role in game development could be something kind of similar. It could be like the first player in a way to sort of reflect back to the rest of the team, you know, where things are really at or something.
Yeah, it's not easy, I'm sure. I'm sure many folks have pulled out their hair. I'm not gonna name you, Nate, because we're both bald, but that's what I'm saying. We're just there together. I dig it. the fists are raised in solidarity. Greg, I'm curious to hear your thoughts about when it comes to Hades and the very specific genre around roguelikes. I think, you know, roguelikes have this reputation of being super difficult, and you know, Hades manages to give players this really sizable challenge while, you know, bringing in new players and helping them to kind of understand that failure isn't necessarily a detriment. It can sometimes be a rewarding experience in that way. You know, how have you kind of figured out, and you and the team, balancing out gameplay and narrative to kind of achieve this really rewarding experiences for the audience?
Yeah, I think it started with an observation that's similar to what you said, which is that we felt that we had a point of view on this genre that we love so much that we hadn't really seen expressed before. And we felt that the pleasures of roguelike games could be potentially made available to more types of players if we kind of acknowledge that the brutal difficulty that this genre is known for is more of a means to an end rather than a defining feature. The defining feature of roguelike games is that they're uniquely different each time you play. So they have to kill you, because if you played forever, you wouldn't be able to replay them and wouldn't be able to experience what's so cool about them. So and at the same time, if they're brutally difficult, that may get you to, you know, rage quit out or what have you. It's like, then you're also not experiencing what's great about these games. So we thought, like, how can we make the experience of replaying more compelling and make that moment of inevitable failure something that maybe you almost look forward to? And the narrative, it's funny for maybe to hear someone like me say it, because as the writer of the game, but I do look at it as kind of like a means to that end. It's like one of the tools we use to make it so that you maybe are okay with dying in this game because you know you're going to like advance your storylines, you're going to see your pals in the House of Hades. So it's something that, you know, we worked on all project long, but it was one of the very first things that we focused on. So I think, you know, we always try to we want to have the outcome where the thing we spent the most time on turns out to be one of the best aspects of the game. So I'm glad that it turned out okay because it was a big undertaking for us.
Yeah, I was always curious to see how you kind of philosophize that in your minds of saying, you know, this is a thing that we want you to experience because it will kind of thrust you forward in that space and kind of give you more space to move, which is kind of great.
If I could just jump in for 1 second, just want to kind of geek out a little bit because hearing Greg Kasavin talk about what they were striving for with their roguelike game is pretty great because I just have to say it worked. Hades is just fantastic. And the tools that you guys use to get people to enjoy playing a roguelike over and over, it really came together and it sings in the final product. So I just got to say it's nice to hear you talk about it because the intention is reflected in the final product.
We really learned so much from games that came before us and people who have had way more experience working on these kinds of games than we did ourselves. So we felt like we were, if nothing else, kind of working in a tradition that we wanted to respect and try to come up with something that, you know, had a reason to be within a genre that is filled with amazing games. So.
Yeah, nice. I love hearing that, and thank you. Thank you for sharing that, Greg. I appreciate that. I'm gonna go right back to you, actually, and talk about, you know, Half-Life Alyx in that way. You know, there are a lot of things that people were really excited about when initially hearing about anything Half-Life coming out into the world, and being really excited to see anything kind of, you know, spark off of that original IP, you know. What were some of the conversations when you first kind of started the process of developing a completely new take on Half-Life for VR? What were the teams kind of like, oh man, we're going to do this thing now. We know we've said we're going to do it and we're actually going to start pushing forward with this project. And you know, what does that mean for Half-Life? What does that mean for, you know, Valve in a bigger kind of conversation? What was the, you know, what was it like to kind of make that be a real thing?
Well, we at Valve we had been running experiments inside the company with virtual reality for a while before we really sunk our teeth into anything to do with Half-Life. And then we started to prototype some things that were Half-Life related. And by the time we got into that with any depth, we really quickly knew that we had something compelling, a kernel that we could build around. We were pretty confident about that, but we were very nervous about the idea of proceeding forward despite that confidence, because we just were not sure that we could convince everyone in the world that it was worth following us into the VR space with the Half-Life genre, or sorry, the IP. We were nervous about announcing the game far more than we were nervous about the product we were making, because asking everyone to take on, you know, the equipment necessary to have this experience is a big ask. But as we were building the actual game, there were just tons of interesting conversations, as you would expect, exploring the medium and trying to figure out how do you bring all of this formula, if you want to call it one, that results in a Half-Life like experience that has to do with combat and storytelling and, you know, generally FPS compelling characters, and bring it into this new place that's so new for everyone, where they've got to absorb all those same things while they're figuring out, you know, how to use their body and aim a gun and pick stuff up off the floor and look around. And that was really fun to work through. I mean, the whole team just really, really had a blast kind of figuring out how do you balance all those things together. So it was a good time.
Yeah. It's always one of those things of trying to figure out, you know, when you are, and it was an interesting conversation that I had with a couple of folks about when I first heard that Alyx was going to be a thing. And the first thought that I had was, I wonder how excited everyone was as soon as they knew that they were going to jump on this project and kind of start the road down that path. So I'm happy to hear that, you know, there was some cohesion in that in the conversations that you were all having at Valve for that. Nate and Jason, I want to dig really quickly into, you know, you both worked on a fantastic game that was built around 13th century samurai, you know, in the year of 2020. You know, what were some of the kind of influences that you both brought into the game for game direction? Did you feel like there were lots of things to kind of pull in to snag and kind of build out the conversation for the fundamentals of that game? I'm going to start off with you, Jason, first.
Yeah, I think Nate and I have some overlap and some that are probably more personal to each other. But for me, you know, definitely creating, when we first said we were going to create a game in feudal Japan, Nate and I had this conversation. And, at that time, I had never really been to Japan. It was on my list of places that I'd always wanted to go, frankly, because you hear how beautiful it is and how just exotically beautiful and just mesmerizing. And, you know, it was at the top of my list of places that I wanted to go to. And then, you know, also interested in history and, so for me, I got pretty excited about going down the road of watching a bunch of samurai films. And, you know, I feel like I watched every one ever made. And so that was a huge inspiration, creating a game that was, you know, set in an open world version of feudal Japan, being able to, you know, roam anywhere you'd like to go, was really super appealing. But, you know, I could almost picture it before we'd had even started, just because of how, just hadn't played that and seen that really. So I got really excited about that and depict how we would depict it. And felt like there was just so many options that we could do. And it was really exciting. And everyone we told was immediately excited about it. So that certainly helped. So definitely watching a lot of samurai movies was a big part of my earliest inspiration for sure.
Nate, what about you on that end?
Oh, without a doubt, the core inspiration is classic samurai films like Yojimbo and Seven Samurai. There's this just humanity to those films that makes you really want to take on the role of being a samurai. Pair that with an open world and an external conflict like a Mongol invasion, and you know, all that on top of the romance of feudal Japan, it's all pretty alluring. But you know, I think we always go back to classic samurai films because frankly, there are so many different versions of what a samurai can be. And you know, we're Sucker Punch is an American team. And so we need to pick a lane as how we might think of that identity. And frankly, also do a lot of research to make sure that when we say, okay, we're going to go with the Kurosawa form, you know, that we represent it in a way that is, that has a feeling of authenticity to gamers around the world who kind of recognize things that you don't know that you know. I mean, Jason brought it up earlier, but like having consultants who show you how to correctly draw a bow, you don't know that you've seen that in a movie before where they, you know, filmed in Japan that showed you how that was the right way to draw a longbow. And until you have an expert, you know, kind of point that out, you're just not aware. And so having a objective, like a character fantasy objective, then backed up with research and help, that was amazing.
Yeah. Well, gents, thank you very, very much for your thoughts on all of this. And now I get to do the super, super fun part of giving away our DICE award for outstanding achievement in game direction. For this year, our winner for outstanding achievement in game direction goes to Hades. Congrats.
Right. Nice.
Yes.
Greg, if you have a second or two for a couple of quick words, I know.
Yeah.
We'd love to hear.
Oh my goodness. It's unbelievably humbling among this group. This group includes like my personal favorite games of the year. So it's just all the more reason, you know, I played your games and I'm in awe of them. So part of this is very surreal for me, but I really, as mentioned, I really owe it. I owe this to the team, my longtime colleagues, all seven of us who were there from the Bastion days, we're all still together. And the direction, such as it is at Supergiant, in some respects, I think we've got it a lot easier than some of you folks because our team is small. And I think strictly speaking, direction is easier with fewer people. But we've found our ability to keep the team together and work past our kind of individual idiosyncrasies and be able to find these concepts that resonate personally with each of us and have the trust in each of us to kind of do our best work and seek inspiration from one, you know, whenever we poke our heads up from our individual work, we get inspired by the work that goes on around us. That's certainly helped a lot to get to this point. And I'm just so grateful to work with a group of people that has put the faith in me to do what I get to do, because it's the kind of job that I never would have gotten had I just applied for it. It took a couple of friends trusting me. So So thank you so much for thinking of our game for this. It's an incredible honor.
Congrats, thank Greg. You. Well deserved.
Yeah, congrats, big congrats, Greg. Yeah. Greg's awesome.
Yeah, congrats, man.
Yeah. Very, very cool. Gentlemen, thank you so, so much for being with us today. Again, congratulations, Greg, for bringing this home for the Hades team. Nate, Jason, Greg, Jake, Kurt, and Anthony, thank you so much for being here with us today. We really do appreciate the time. And again, hopefully we can all do this again sometime soon in the real world. That would be fantastic to be able to hang out and chop this up in those nice ways. So again, thank you all, and we'll see you all soon.
For Academy members and interested developers and publishers, submissions are now open for the 25th Annual DICE Awards, the premier peer-reviewed celebration of the best in interactive entertainment. Make sure to submit your 2021 game for consideration by Tuesday, December 7th at 5 p.m. PT. For more information, visit interactive.org.